This is an iHeart podcast.
The economy sucks. We're going to talk to Carol Roth about that. Bill Jacobson is here talking about lawfare, culture war stuff. Aaron Wexler. We have such a great night on I'm Right. All right, let's talk about the economic numbers that came out today. We just have such a huge show for you with economy stuff, lawfare stuff. Carol Roth is going to join us to talk about these economic numbers in a couple minutes. It's a huge show tonight, so let's deal with the numbers. GDP. First of all, let's wrap our minds around something before we get into the GDP numbers themselves. It was supposed to increase. The economy was supposed to grow at 2.4. Instead, it grew at 1.6. That is a large number. You look at that and you think, wow, that's not that bad. They only missed it by less than a percentage point. When you consider we're talking about a $20 trillion economy, missing it by almost an entire point is a really, really, really big deal. All right, so let's deal with this. What's happening out there right now? Well, what's happening is we've spent the longest time printing money that's not backed. And spending, out of control spending. You realize right now, as a country, we are spending at levels, percentage-wise, that we have not spent since World War II. Wrap your mind around that. World War II was one of these all-hands-on-deck situations, pass bill after bill after bill. We need new aircraft carriers. We need new planes. More troops. We got to do this. The largest event in world history prompted government spending at the levels we're currently spending. Except there's no World War III. There's no national emergency. So they're not stopping. They're accelerating. Right now, every single thing is accelerating, meaning the stalling of the economy is accelerating. The growth of the debt is accelerating. The interest on the debt based off that is accelerating. Inflation is accelerating. I was hesitant to even say it because you already know it. We don't have to go economic numbers. Well, I mean, the Wall Street Journal says today, you know this. Everyone knows this. When you live today, you buy anything, you can see what's happening out there. And this is part of why I've been so angry at the GOP and Democrats for the spending. For the longest time, I've been angry about the spending, but lately, I'm getting more and more angry. Why? Because, look, even if 10 years ago you could deny that the spending was a problem, the debt was a problem, well, Jesse, I think we can withstand it. Nobody can deny what we're seeing now. No Republican, no Democrat, nobody who can read can deny the fact that the boat is taking on water so quickly that we're going under. And still, the people at the highest levels of power in this country talk, well, like Mitch McConnell talks.
Is $60 billion enough money for Ukraine to push back Russia decisively?
Well, we hope so. It's actually only 0.2% of our gross domestic product. So put in that context, it's not a whole lot of money for us.
Not a whole lot of money. It's just 0.2%. It's just $60 billion. Why are you whining? These people, they don't care. They know all the numbers. They have all the numbers I have. You and I, we don't have special access to these numbers that they don't have access to. Mitch McConnell knows everything about the debt, the interest rates, inflation, and they just don't give a crap. We found out today from the AARP, 25% of people 50 and older believe they will never retire. They simply can't afford it. The American dream for Americans, it's not being destroyed in the future. You know, it's not troubles that are coming. They're happening now. Right now, wealth is disappearing. Small businesses disappearing. The middle class disappearing. Old people getting crushed. People on fixed incomes getting crushed. You can't avoid inflation. No one can escape it. I can't, you can't, nobody can. The spending, the printing has brought us here, and no one's stopping. No one's even slowing down. bad. It's really, really bad. And the problem with bad economies and bad economic situations when it's debt and interest and inflation is bad almost always leads to more bad. It really, really snowballs terribly. And actually, that's what we're going to talk to Carol Roth about. So let's talk to her. So joining me now, the wonderful Carol Roth, author of many books, but her latest is particularly on the nose for where we're at today, titled You Will Own Nothing, highly recommended. Okay, Carol, the GDP, we wanted it to grow 2.4. It didn't do that. It grew 1.6. When you're talking about a $20 trillion economy, that tiny little eighth of a percentage point is kind of a really big deal. What are we looking at today?
So this was an ugly GDP report and is not going to be a surprise to probably you, Jesse, to me, to people who have been following this, because the emperor has no clothes. And while there's been a lot of distractions with laser light shows to make him appear to some people as though he's been wearing clothes, it is now becoming more and more clear that he's absolutely naked. So we saw some pretty paltry growth, 1.6%, as you said. And this is coming at a time when we're showing deficits to GDP, which are kind of double the historic average. So that means that we're getting, you know, less bang for our buck as the government continues to spend. They are not able to turn that into any growth. Surprise, surprise, the government isn't a good steward of capital and not productive with money, and it would be better in the hands of the private sector. Again, many of us knew that. At the same time, one of the things in this report was what was going on with prices. So you might expect, as the economy is beginning to slow, that maybe some of that inflation would be slowing down as well to match it. But no, of course not. Because as we know, everybody has been doing the wrong thing, including the government in that respect. So we saw that prices, the price component of this report, started to accelerate again. That also beat expectations in the wrong way. So that means that we're seeing increasing inflation, which again, many of us knew. So when you have an economy that is stagnating and you have an inflation that is increasing, you get something that we've talked about before, which is called stagflation, which is sort of the buffet of the worst options kind of left over for you. And when you hear people like Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan Chase saying, I'm worried that we are going to have an economy that looks a little bit more like the 70s. That was where you saw a double dip in inflation, or I guess you'd say a double spike in inflation. We saw it come up, go down, and go back up again. And then you ended up with many years of this stagflationary environment. So that's really what we're seeing. It puts the Fed between a rock and a hard place in terms of their decisions. But at the end of the day, this is all the government's fault. And until they get their act together, which is going to be never, we're in for a stagnating economy and more inflation.
Okay, so since neither of us are going to hold our breath until the government gets its act together, where does this take us? Because this may be similar to the 70s, but there is something way, way different than the 70s, and that's our debt to GDP ratio,
yeah.
Carol. I know it was bad in the 70s. Today it's suicidal. That is drastically different today than it was 50 years ago. That component of it, the interest rates, the debt to GDPs, the servicing of the debt, how does that hurt us more?
So when we're looking at what the Fed might do and the decisions that they're thinking about making, I would argue that they should cut rates. But the normal thinking, because I, of course, am not a normal thinker, although I'm usually right about these things, the normal thinking is, oh, they're going to cut interest rates and that is going to stoke inflation. And that's something they don't want to do. They don't want to be on the hook for that higher inflation that they told us wasn't coming and was transitory and all of that good stuff, even though they don't have the right tools to fix that, and the government's completely moving in the opposite direction and working against them. So if they're seeing inflation go up, now the market's starting to ask itself, well, could they hike interest rates? And that's where it really puts us in a potential world of hurt, because we've seen the projections. Bank of America a few weeks ago projected that by the end of the year, if there was no changes to spending and there was no changes to Fed interest rates, by the end of the year, we'd be at a run rate of $1.6 trillion in terms of the interest we're paying on our debt. It would be the biggest line item in the budget, bigger than Social Security, Medicare, all of those other things. So that we'd be spending the most on paying for the debt for the things that we've already bought. Now, if the Fed were to increase interest rates, then that would add to that amount. And then that becomes, in my opinion, even more inflationary as well, because that means that we have even bigger deficits that we need to finance. The, you know, demand for our debt is not great, as we know. Central banks around the world have been net sellers of debt for the last 10 years. And so people are going to be demanding, investors are demanding higher prices for that. So we are really in this really bad place of fiscal dominance. What the Fed needs to do, again, is not say we're going to lower, we're going to raise. They need to go to the government and say, you got to get your act together because we're trying to do this thing and you're doing exactly the opposite. You're working against them. But it's an election year. That's not going to happen. Powell's, you know, said as much as he's going to say. And so, you know, there are a lot of potential outcomes depending on what the policy ends up being, but none of them are good for the average American, whether that ends up being, you know, higher inflation or they do something where they go back to a 70s type of policy and really raise interest rates and completely tank the economy, or, you know, and you again, you could end up with some cycle of both of those. So again, the middle and working class are getting screwed. It's being done by government and monetary policy. We've been telling you that this is the consequence, and you cannot have central planners messing with the economy for 15 years and expect that you're going to get out of this without any consequences. Unfortunately, the people who are in charge are not the ones who are accountable for those consequences. It is you and your family and your bank account.
Carol, let's circle back to the interest on the debt portion of that, because I caught that same thing too, that it was already going to be a big fat number without interest rates going up.
Yeah.
How do we deal with that number as a country, with the interest only loan and we can't cover the payments? How do we even begin to tackle that problem?
Well, this goes back to math. There are only so many things that you can do. You know, one of them is you can have a productivity miracle. We could have a breakthrough in quantum computing or some kind of, you know, amazing nuclear fission energy, something like that. And we can really grow the economy side and we can get more money to, you know, keep this all in balance. You know, is it a possibility? Yes, but, you know, I wouldn't be putting my odds on that. They could go back and try and cut some of the programs and some of the government spending. We know that that's not going to happen. So they continue to run up this debt, which is going to be, the deficit's going to be increased and the debt ultimately increased by more and more interest payments. And that means they have to finance that. And when you don't have enough buyers at least a certain price, they have two choices. They don't have enough buyers that they raise up the interest that they're going to charge and try and attract more people, which would suck more money out of private investments and again create even more debt for or more interest for us, or ultimately they have some sort of monetization of the debt like we saw over the past, you know, couple of years during the COVID scenario. And we know that that itself is inflationary. And so that's why I'm so focused on this, you know, sticky inflation thesis, because it is coming, you know, not just from the monetary policy side, it's coming from this fiscal foundation. If we don't have the people to buy the debt at a reasonable price, eventually the Fed in some way, shape or form, whatever they call it, they come up with these weird names and programs all the time, but they're going to find a way to monetize it. That is the printing of more money. And that means that is ruining your purchasing power.
Yeah, Lee, which brings us finally to BRICS. I know that we're not going to get off the dollar being the world's reserve currency tomorrow. I'm not naive, but man, Carol, it sure seems like we're inching towards that direction, doesn't it?
Well, I think that this is something that's been building for a long time. I talked about this in And You Will Own Nothing. And certainly, as the US has not only neglected the dollar, as the reserve currency, keeping it stable either domestically or on an international basis. And now we have the weaponization of the dollar. You've got Yellen, who's trying to get all these Russian reserves and flip them over, cash them in, and give them to Ukraine. Countries around the world are going, yeah, I don't know that we want to keep our money with the US and in US treasuries. And that's why central banks around the world have been net sellers over the last 10 years. We've had almost $17 trillion of debt we've issued. And on a net basis, central banks have sold about $100 billion over that time. So they are not the ones buying our currency. What they're buying, though, Jesse, is not another currency. It's not like they're going and replacing the US dollar with something, the currency of another country. What they're replacing it with is gold. And that's what we're seeing over and over again. These countries, particularly the Chinas of the world, Russia, Turkey to some extent, that they have been loading up on gold as the reserve. And they're using that not to officially back their currency, but sort of as a settlement. So as those countries trade amongst themselves and there is maybe a little bit that's left over, instead of settling that in the yuan, the Chinese currency, they say, well, if you want, you can trade that in for gold. And so I think that we're going to see that being a more and more important part of what's happening globally, because that is something that no matter what country you're in, all the central banks have some amount of it. Certainly we've got a 5,000 year plus social contract around it. So I would look, instead of having some other currency, necessarily supplant the US dollar, I think that you could see gold playing more of a role. But what it does mean here in the United States is that with the dollar not having this sort of privileged position, is it means everything's going to be more expensive for us, bottom line. And so I think we're going to be living through several decades going forward that are nothing like the ones that we grew up in. And it's not going to be to our benefit unless, again, we have a productivity miracle, which changes everything. So if you're putting forth investment dollars as a government, that's where you should be putting it towards. But certainly that's not what they're doing.
No doubt about it. Carol, thank you, ma'am. You are the best.
My pleasure.
All right. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I'm right. And so is she. Lawfare makes you uncomfortable, too. We'll talk to Bill Jacobson about what happened at the Supreme Court. We'll talk to him next. Before we talk to Bill, let's talk about your feet. Your feet. You've heard of gravity defier by now. Everyone has. Why? Why is everyone talking about gravity defier? Shoes? Why? Well, people are starting to wake up and realize your feet are everything. Everything. You need to take care of them. Gravity defier, every pair comes with custom orthotics. You see, your shoes need to be made for your feet, not the general public's feet, your feet. And that's what gravity defier brings to you at the end of the day. Wouldn't you love to have your feet feel good? Not sore, not tired, not achy, but good. Yeah, even that little spot on your heel that bothers you can have that. You know that, right? Here's what you need to do. Go to GDEFY.com. Use the promo code Jesse so you save yourself a pile of money. GDEFY.com. We'll be back. There was a big immunity case today in front of the Supreme Court, arguments in front of the Supreme Court. How immune is Donald Trump from all the various things that they're throwing at him? I don't know. I don't know how it went today. Of course, some justices sounded like it was going to go well for Trump. Some didn't. Joining me now, the great William A. Jacobson, founder of Legal Insurrection, professor at Cornell. Okay, Bill, you heard it today. You have a much different ear than I have, meaning yours is educated, mine is not. How'd this go for Trump today?
I'd say it went well. I don't think he's going to hit a home run here. I don't think his case is going to be thrown out as such. The issue is whether official prosecution. And I think that's what the court's going to rule. The answer is yes on that. But they're not going to say this case against Donald Trump gets thrown out. They'll send it back down to the district court, in all likelihood, and say that you've got to examine it under our ruling. So I think he'll get a legal win here, but he's not going to get a win in the real sense. What he will get is even more delay in that trial, which would push it to after the election.
Okay, that's good. Tell us why we're not going to get the win-win that many Trump supporters would want, and most people looking at this think we should get. Why not?
I think because the court is just hesitant to get very deep in the weeds of the indictment. I think it was Justice Barrett today was going over some of the allegations and some of the claims and asking the attorney for Trump, is this official business or is this private business? And the answers went back and forth. I just don't see the court going through a lengthy indictment paragraph by paragraph and saying this is in, this is out. That's something that normally a district court would do. So I think they will issue a pronouncement of law. They will uphold the question that was before them. When this was brought to them, they said, we will accept this case on the following question. And I'm paraphrasing now. Are the official actions of a president immune from prosecution? And if so, to what extent? So they will rule that this is either immune or not. And they may even rule the breadth of the immunity. But I don't see them pulling out the indictment and going through it line by line and saying this is in, this is out. That's not something the Supreme Court normally does.
Okay. All right, let's set that aside. Trump was not there today, although I'm sure he wanted to be. Trump was in New York City, where he's required to be at this ridiculous trial that everyone knows is ridiculous. But ridiculous doesn't mean it's not going poorly for him. How is it going there?
Yeah, it's hard to know. We only know what the media reports. So I wish it was live streamed. I wish we could watch it ourselves and reach our own conclusions. What the prosecution appears to be doing is proving a lot of stuff that is not in and of itself illegal. The relationship with whoever, the money paid. There's nothing illegal about paying someone to be quiet. That happens every day in lawsuits around the country, probably hundreds of times a day in the United States. Someone gets money and part of that payment is a non-disclosure agreement. Nothing unusual about that. But that's what they seem to be starting the case with. They want, as if they need to convince a Manhattan jury to hate Trump, they want the jury to hate Trump and to show that he did all sorts of, you know, nefarious stuff, but none of it's illegal. So it seems that they're not, that's what their strategy is, to build up the anti-Trump aspect of the trial.
Yeah, like you said, as if they need any help to hate Trump any more than they already do in a place like Manhattan. Okay, let's shift gears to the classified documents case, because for the longest time you've been telling us this is the one that really may bite him. This is the one, at least to you, I'm paraphrasing, looks most legitimate and like he may burn for it. What do you make of this redacted, unredacted documents update?
Yeah, that didn't strike me as usually significant. A lot of people are making a big deal about that. And I think you fairly paraphrased my position on this, was that of the cases, this is the one where he had the greatest exposure. Because rather than like New York City or DC or Georgia, they are not relying on convoluted novel legal theories. They're either going to prove their case or they're not going to prove their case down in Florida. But that to me was the most straightforward and the most risk to him. I think these documents that have been released, based upon what I've seen, the analysis is, it shows a bumbling government. It shows a government that doesn't really know what it's doing, but that doesn't necessarily relieve him of whatever legal obligations he had. So I think that the case is the same case it was before those redacted documents were released.
We got some pretty significant news out of Arizona as well. We have, I believe, 11, yes, grand jury indicted 11 Trump allies, everyone from Mark Meadows to Rudy Giuliani. What is this? Another ridiculous thing? Are those people going to prison? What's happening here?
Yeah, and this one has to do with an alternative slate of electors proposed by the Trump team, maybe not him himself, but they felt Arizona was stolen from them and they wanted there to be a slate of electors ready to go. And that is the issue. They are being charged with fraud, deceiving people as to these electors and falsely portraying them as the legitimate electors. The problem with this case, in reality, forget what jury they're going to have, is that no one was deceived. Everybody knew exactly what Trump was doing or his supporters were doing. They didn't think the election was fair. They think it was stolen. And they were proposing their own slate of electors. Nobody was tricked. It wasn't hidden. It all took place in plain sight. So I think that is, you know, really a incorrect theory that this was a fraudulent attempt to deceive people. But that's not the point of this. With all of these, why is this being brought now at the end of April? It's because we're entering into the election season in Arizona, and there's a hotly contested Senate race, which may come down to how much bad coverage this gets. And so why wasn't this brought 2 years ago? Every single fact in this has been known for a long time, is 3.5 years old. Why wasn't this brought a year or two? We could have had that trial. People would have either been convicted or not convicted, but it wouldn't have interfered with the election. So what this Democrat prosecutor in Arizona has done is she has now frozen a significant part of the leadership of the Republican Party in Arizona with these indictments. They're not going to be able to really do anything. So again, whether it has merit or it doesn't, every single one of these cases, with the exception of Mar-a-Lago, because that all took place later in time, but every one of these other cases could have easily been brought 2 years ago. We would know the results and voters could make their choices, but they were deliberately delayed until the election year. And that's all people really need to know about this case, is that this was delayed for 3.5 years in order to be dropped right on the eve of a Senate election.
Okay, so we all know the deal. This is lawfare. That word's been thrown around a bunch because that's what it is. Okay, this is all bad. It's evil. It's wrong. It shouldn't happen. But it is happening, Bill. What does that mean for the country if this kind of thing can happen? Even if, let's say, Trump gets away with all this stuff and his people get out from all this stuff and they get out from under it, this very clearly is just how the country, how Democrats at least, are going to run elections from now on. Shouldn't there be something in place to stop this?
Yeah, there should be, but it's very difficult because there's an imbalance, and there's an imbalance of evil here. The Democrats are willing to do this stuff. Republican prosecutors are not. And that's always the disparity. You always hear people say, oh, Democrats have opened the door to this. They will regret the day that they did this to Donald Trump. No, they won't, because there's no Republican prosecutor who's going to do this. There's no Republican prosecutor who's going to wait 2.5 or 3 years to dump a case on the eve of elections in key swing states. So they'd get away with it. I don't know what the answer is. I wish I had the answer to it. The answer to it is to somehow, despite all these shenanigans, still win the election. And when you get put in power, change the laws so this can't happen. But there is a difference in agenda here and a difference in how people operate. So it is a real problem, and I wish I had the answer to it, how you can rein in rogue local Democrat prosecutors.
Bill, you're a professor at an Ivy League university, so I'm gonna acknowledge that before I ask what I'm about to ask, but I can't let you go without asking about all the protests all over campus. It's all over the place, Columbia, NYU. It's everywhere at our most elite universities. And what I'm struggling with right now, Bill, is why I should care. It's not that I don't value high education. I want our country to have a great higher education system. It's an important part of a country, but we don't. At least in many pockets, we don't. They produce these anti-American kids who hate the friggin' place, and then they go on to run the country. So if a bunch of dirty street commies on the street are messing with the administrators, why do I give a crap?
Yeah, well, I think you just mentioned why it matters, because these are the kids who are moving into the government, who are moving into Democrat prosecutors' offices, who are moving into Google and suppressing people. These are the people who, this is a serious problem. No, I don't think you need to care about tents on the lawn at Columbia. Nobody really cares about that. But the fact that elite education particularly is so corrupted politically, I think affects the whole country. What people need to understand is that these are really what's happening this year is different than in the past. This is a combination of far leftist, almost Khmer Rouge style people who want to tear down our society and start again at year zero. It's combined with the Islamists who want to tear down our society and start in the 8th century again. So this is a really toxic movement, and people need to understand Israel is simply the excuse. Israel is the organizing mechanism for them. They can gin up universal hatred of Jews and universal hatred of Israel, but Israel is not really the target. The United States is the target. They hate us. They are forming what they call liberated zones. Liberated from what? Liberated from our country. That's what they're liberated from. They refer to the United States as Turtle Island. Turtle Island is the mythical name that some Native Americans give to the creation of the earth. They literally want to tear us down. They do not recognize our own sovereignty in this country. They're liberating themselves from our sovereignty. They want to destroy us. That's why people should care.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish it was different. Bill, thank you so much. Wishing you the best. All right. Let's talk about those Ivy League schools. In fact, we have a graduate of one of those Ivy League schools. Before we do that, let's talk about, well, what are they missing? What are we missing as a nation? Many things, but what's one of the main things? We're missing patriotism. That's really it. Patriotism. So much of what we're seeing simply comes back to love of country and our lack of it. Look, it's why we have to be more purposeful with our money, with where we spend and don't spend it. There are a million places you can go buy coffee. How many coffee shops would print a mug like that? How many? None. Blackout Coffee will. Coffee is amazing. Blackout Coffee is the best I've ever had. Honestly, even if it sucked, I would order it because they love my values. They love my country. When the other coffee companies are buying Black Lives Matter, Planned Parenthood stuff, Blackout Coffee cares about my country. 20% off your first order, blackoutcoffee.com/Jesse. 2 cups every day. That's what I have. And maybe have one or two of these. blackoutcoffee.com/Jesse. We'll be back. That was Harvard. USC announced today they're not even having a graduation speech. I think this is all fantastic. I wonder if Erin disagrees with me, though. Joining me now, Erin Wexler, political commentator. You can find her. She's outstanding on Instagram, non-lib take. All right, Erin, obviously it's not good to have a bunch of dirty communist scum destroying American universities, kill all the Jews and all that stuff. That's obviously not ideal. But the American university system is poison. A bunch of Americans are now realizing it's poison. And I think in the end, that's a good thing.
Yeah, Jesse, the first, thanks for having me. And I definitely agree with you. This is one of my favorite subjects right now. As an Ivy League graduate, I hope you and your audience will not hold that against me. But when I actually graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. When I was there, we actually colloquially referred to it as the Juniversity of Pennsylvania. And back then we were doing things like taking finance exams and writing history papers. And even back then, which was almost a decade ago, it was very evident that the university was turning into what is essentially a woke madrasa. Even I could not have predicted things would be this bad. The administration, the students, the faculty, they are so far to the left. They are churning out Marxists who are basically taking classes in roadside bomb making and underwater hijab weaving. So, you know, at this point, I agree with you. I've seen your tweets online, and I love to see this. This is the educational enema that these institutions need. There's been a lot of bullshit building up for a long time, and it is time to flush it out. So, you know, we have some of these soft conservatives who are saying, oh, this is so terrible to see. It's, you know, if people like us who love watching this, like I love watching this. And for those of us who do, they would argue that, you know, we're celebrating the fall of great American institutions. These institutions are not American anymore. They were infiltrated a long time ago. The American flag was lowered. And some of these clips, you'll see the students actually lowering the American flag, raising terrorist flags over the schoolyard. So this is, I think, absolutely necessary, and I'm just glad that everyone gets to see it now.
Yeah, me too. I will know we will have succeeded if I can go to one neighborhood party in my area and not have one of my neighbors bragging that Aiden, Jaden, and Braden got into Yale. Oh, these universities, their reputation needs to go the way the university has gotten. I am curious, though. You were at some fancy school like UPenn, very similar to the community college I went to. Did you feel this stuff coming when you were there? Meaning, did it feel like it was getting darker? They've always been Democrat. They've always been, you know, crappy libs. But did you feel something sinister, or is this just really recent?
Yeah, well, first, and credit to you, Jesse, I do think that now your college ranking is definitely inversely correlated to your intelligence level. So you're one-upping me on that. Way to brag about your degree. But yeah, no, it was really clear when I was an undergrad that things were heading in the wrong direction. And this is what the left is really effective at, right? They're really good at the slow boil of the frog. And I think a huge problem we've had on the right is letting them get away with it. For us, it's always been live and let live, and you know, it's not so bad. And they just slowly turn the temperature up on us little by little. So when I was there, it was seemingly small things, but I at the time could identify it. And I was actually asked to be the president of College Republicans when I was there. So just to give you a sense, I've always been very, very conservative and very vocal when I was on campus. But they were doing things like, you know, getting rid of Greek life and getting fraternities in trouble because the administration saw that as, you know, the patriarchy and the rich white male, even though like many liberal policies, it wound up backfiring because with the fraternities on campus, you could have parties that everyone could attend that were, you know, free for people. And in getting them off campus, it actually just made certain social activities even more exclusive and even more expensive. So we saw whether it was in our social life, the teachers. I was both in Wharton undergrad and the liberal arts school, so I got a taste of both. And even in Wharton, which I went to because I saw it as the final beacon of capitalism in this country, in the Ivy League, and that's why I wanted to go to Penn. Even there, we had professors who were just trying to shove liberal, almost socialist agendas down our throats all the time. And as these professors retired, the old school, you know, the old guard, they were white men, and they were always replaced with a DEI hire without fail. And then don't even get me started about the liberal arts school, because, you know, that was, you know, it was like jihadi training camp over there. But even Wharton was infiltrated back then, and it only got progressively worse. And I think we all know that post-COVID, the left decided that they had free rein to do whatever they want, and that was especially true on college campuses.
Gosh, even Wharton. I don't know why I'm shocked to hear that. Of course it would be Wharton too, but Wharton, now everyone knows about Wharton, even dummies like me who could never get in. Everyone knows about Wharton. Did you get the sense that some of your professors or administrators, that they knew this stuff was bad, and maybe they were afraid, maybe pushing back, but only pushing back a little, don't want to lose that tenure? I'm trying to figure out, basically, Aaron, at these high-level schools, do we have any friends left?
I know we do have friends left. When I was an undergrad, that we're talking 2011 to 2015, I could always sniff out my conservative professors because they were the only ones not shoving an agenda down your throat, right? So that's how I was able to identify them. I do recall also the day after Barack Obama was elected president in 2012, crying as I handed a finance midterm and saying to my professor, "What's the point?" And he said, "We will get through this." But besides that one professor, I did find that most of them truly believe this. They actually are Marxists in these institutions. And it does make sense now. The DEI hiring practices are so rampant. It is almost impossible to get hired in any of these places unless you totally subscribe to these. You know, they could sniff you out. And I think conservatives just stay quiet. You have to subscribe to these ideas. I think we have few friends left, but generally these are people who've never lived in the real world, never held a real job, and they have their fantastical ideas, and they just sit in these institutions getting paid, some of them actually a lot of money. The DEI admins get paid a lot more than professors, so that's turned out to be a great gig. I just don't really have hope in these institutions. I don't think it's worth any penny sending your kid to these schools. Even if you have a full ride at this point, I don't know what you gain from going to places where, instead of right now, you know, this time when I was a student, I'd be sweating in the library, so nervous about finals. I don't know how these kids feel comfortable sitting in the middle of college campus, you know, just protesting something that has nothing to do with their exams. So I think that you'll be better served going elsewhere or not going to school and getting a skill set and going into the real world. So that is my message to anyone here with a teenager thinking of going to an Ivy League school. I certainly would not let my kid go to an Ivy League school.
That is quite a statement. The library. You know, I don't even know if my community college had a library. I never did see it, though. Erin, thank you so much. Appreciate you, as always. All right. Now, we need to talk about power. The president and power. Before we talk about that, let's talk about your power, your timeshare. You see, you feel powerless because you can't get out of it. You've called, hey, guys, we don't use it anymore. Can you let us go? No, they tell you no. You've sent emails. Hey, but we haven't used this in 2 years. You won't even let us in. Let us out. And the timeshare company keeps telling you, no, you can't. Sorry. Pay your annual fees. Pay up. Special assessments. And you feel powerless, but you are not powerless because Lone Star Transfer exists to hand you that power back. This is a family business. They have an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau for a reason. What do they do at Lone Star Transfer? Well, they get you out legally and permanently. They put it in writing. They give you a time frame. Talk about the ultimate Babe Ruth calling of the shot. They will get you out, and they'll tell you when. You're not powerless. You just have to make a phone call. One phone call. 844-310-2646. Wrap your arms around the power you have and call Lone Star Transfer, all right? We'll be back. You know, one of the things that we try not to forget on this show, or maybe we do try to forget it, it's something we bring up is this. The man who holds the power, the top executive in the United States of America, really, oh my gosh, the most powerful person on the planet. It's very reasonable to say the president of the United States is the most powerful person on the planet. He's virtually helpless by this point in time. Yesterday, he was given a speech, and obviously he's reading from the teleprompter. He can't think. He's reading from the teleprompter, and he does this four more years line, and then his staff knew that was kind of one of those lines where the crowd would start chanting, four more years, four more years. So they wrote on his teleprompter, I'm sure it was in parentheses or something, they wrote, pause, four more years, pause. This is the president of the United States of America.
Imagine what we can do next. Four more years, pause.
Four more years, pause. Four more years, pause.
Four more years. Pause. And look, honestly, this is not even on Joe at this point in time. He is what he is. This is on the staffers. This is on whoever's drawing up these speeches. This is not a one-off. This is not the first time. Joe Biden's done this before. Remember when he did the end of quote thing?
The percentage of women who registered to vote and cast a ballot is consistently higher than the percentage of the men who do so. End of quote. Repeat the line.
Repeat the line. We shouldn't laugh. It's not funny, but man, that's the leader of the free world. That's where we are. All right, whatever. We have light in the mood. Next. All right, it is time to lighten the mood, and I have a confession to make. I miss professional sports. You know, I used to watch the NFL for ages. Ages, lived and died for it. And now it's all America sucks crap. I can't watch it anymore. I just can't do it. So I've been looking for more professional sports to watch. And I do know this. Hockey is amazing in person. Not the best on television. But I will say, in my never-ending search to find a new sport, hockey fans are bar none my favorite. Bar none my favorite. You want a little example of hockey fans? Here's one. That's so great. We don't want to see anyone else. Put it back on the kid. I'll see you.
This is an iHeart podcast.